The following is brought to you by the Starfleet Podcast Network, SPN, The Spin. I just like listening to you guys. There's nothing wrong with that.
Sorry, Jefferson. We didn't let you get a word in edgewise.
That is okay. It balances out because there are times where it's like, I may be talking a lot, Vance, Frank. So it's just as you look at everything as a whole, it balances out. Hey everyone, it's Big J, and in just a moment, I will be presenting you with Starship Antilles Episode 6, Together Alone, from George Kahan. Afterwards, please join our critical, not cynical review for our discussions and reactions of the film. Without further ado, here's Starship Antilles Episode 6, titled Together Alone.
Well, I'm waiting. Show yourselves. I don't appreciate having my time wasted.
We have all the time in the universe, while simultaneously we have run out of time.
You obviously brought me down for a purpose. I'd like to know what it is.
We have chosen wisely. You may be the answer we have sought for so long, Captain.
I'm flattered. I represent the United Federation of Planets, and our mandate is to meet new life forms and help them when we can.
A laudable goal, Captain. But we do not require your Federation. Just you.
Me? What do you require of me?
We require your destruction.
Captain's log, stardate 3565.6. The Antilles has been ordered to the central star in the Gemlo sector. For reasons unknown to us at the present time, the sun is losing energy and is threatening all the local planets. Our mission? To find out what is causing the sun to die. I only hope we can come up with an answer before time runs out. Helm, take us in closer.
Aye, sir.
Be prepared for anything, people. This is a new situation. What we do today will have consequences into the future. Mr. Hartwell, status on the environmental systems.
Systems are running normally, sir.
Excellent. Brooks, I want you to scan that sun for unusual readings. Theoretically, if a black hole falls into a sun, that might explain what's going on here. I'm not saying that's what it is, but it's something we have to consider.
Scanning now, Captain.
Helm, be prepared to get us out of here in case the star decides to wake up again.
Course plotted and laid in, sir.
Seen anything like it. What could cause a sun to die?
Captain,
This is gonna take a while. Continue scanning, Lieutenant.
Yes, Captain.
Mr. Dzrok, you have the bridge.
Aye, sir.
Bridge, this is the Captain. Mr. Dzrok, I'm in my quarters and I don't wish to be disturbed. Unless, of course, something important comes up.
Aye, sir.
Thank you. Show yourselves. I don't appreciate having my time wasted.
We have all the time in the universe. While simultaneously, we have run out of time.
You obviously brought me down for a purpose. I'd like to know what it is.
We have chosen wisely. Answer we have sought for so long, Captain.
I'm flattered. I represent the United Federation of Planets, and our mandate is to meet new life forms and help them when we can.
A laudable goal, Captain. But we do not require your Federation. Just you.
Me? What do you require of me?
Require your destruction.
Not if I can help it. You seem like an intelligent being. Why don't you come out and we'll discuss this out in the open?
Very well. But is your request bravery or curiosity?
A little bit of both. Captain Holt Allen.
We know who you are, Captain. Your appearance here is not by accident. You were chosen.
Well, where we come from, it's proper to ask first before transporting someone.
Make no mistake, Captain. We are in charge here. It is irrelevant whether you wanted to come or not.
Not to me. However, let's not get on the wrong track. Manners differ with every species, so I'm not going to judge you too harshly. Yet.
You speak of manners after we have talked about your destruction?
Well, let's just say I'm hoping we come to an understanding. One that doesn't end in my destruction.
Your survival is unlikely. We regret what is about to happen.
Now just hold on a moment. I might be able to solve whatever your problem is from a perspective you do not possess. But I can't help you if I don't know what's going on. I deserve to know why you brought me here.
Giving you any more information will nullify the purpose of you being here. We are dealing with a critical situation, and we have run out of time. If you wish to survive, then you must grasp onto the reality of the moment and decide what must be done.
Oh. man. What do you want me to do?
That is unfortunate.
Beautiful than my home planet. Well, aesthetically speaking, of course.
Since when do you appreciate nature? Doesn't sound like the man I know on the verge of being promoted to starship captain.
I blame you entirely in that regard, my love.
Thanks. I wish we had more time here, Holt.
Me too. Maybe, hey, maybe we'll make this place our permanent home.
What about your home world?
Heavy gravity world, I got no family or friends there. You'd hate it.
Okay.
I'm serious though, Matt. Maybe this could be our place to escape from when we take our breaks. Give it some thought.
Okay.
Lake is just up ahead. This moment would last forever. I really do.
I think you should grow a beard. It would make you look very distinguished, very manly.
A beard? I don't know, it's hard to maintain. Starfleet frowns on that sort of thing. Plus, you know, the male of my species only grows a beard as a sign of remembrance when someone dies.
No.
Beard's out of the question. I want to ask you a question.
Very mysterious.
Listen, I only have 6 more months with the Helena. And you're only stationed for 3 months at Tanabra Base near Saturn. What do you say when our tours end, we get married?
I say okay.
Oh, Matt.
But we have to think about something. It's very, very difficult. These relationships in Starfleet, they don't always last.
You make life worth living. If Starfleet doesn't fit into our plans, we'll make new plans. I love you, Natalie Robertson.
Thank you.
It's almost that time.
Holt, it's going to be a while before we can enjoy a moment like this again. I just want to make sure we're doing the right thing, that we're on the same page. A lot of relationships don't survive Starfleet careers. In the long periods of time that pass without seeing one another...
On the world, Cleo Series 8, there was once a man who believed he could find the greatest treasure if his knowledge of the planet was correct.
Nice.
Many before him thought the same way and failed. Much time had passed and the man had nothing to show for his efforts, despite the fact that his knowledge of the planet was intact. One day there was a terrific earthquake and the land split open. From the opening, a beautiful woman sprang forth and approached the man.
Naturally.
I knew you would come, the man said, for he knew his love had never wavered. And the woman replied, and it was from that love that I sprang forth. And from that moment on, the greatest treasure there ever was came to be, because you cannot put a price on true love.
I do love your stories. Promise me you'll always tell them.
If you wish it, I promise.
My shuttle leaves in the morning. I don't want to go.
I know. But time will pass, and we'll be strong. And at the end of it all, we'll be together. That is my promise to you.
Expect plenty of messages while I'm out running supply shuttles. And I expect you to be saving the galaxy from time to time. Deal?
I'll do my best. How did I get so lucky, Adam?
How did we get so lucky? It was meant to be, Holt. It was meant to be.
Why are you doing this? Why are you forcing me to relive this?
You are the one reliving this. It is with you every day of your life. We are merely tuning into it and channeling the result.
The result? You mean energy, don't you?
Thought can affect reality. Reality affects thought. We need the energy.
I understand. I caught images from you as well. The sun. The sun is central to this mystery.
The time for secrecy is over. We are linked. Speak the truth.
Your ship is a thought bubble. And it malfunctioned and you ended up in this star. And now you don't have enough energy to break free. You need my energy to escape. You need the energy, the intersection between the happiest and saddest moment combined in order for you to achieve escape.
And we are almost out of time to achieve this. If it doesn't happen in this moment, it will never happen. We will live forever in the instant of sun capture. Time immobile.
The pain you're forcing me to relive, something I cannot do, I won't do.
We already know you will. But in order to extract the energy from the memory, it has to be intensified. You may not survive, but no, your destruction will save us all.
I resent this. How dare you assume my life is just a means to an end? It's because you need it. I never said you could use me this way.
For such an intelligent being, how will you not fathom the obvious fact?
And what is that?
You've already made the decision. No matter how much we force you, Some part of you wants to help, wants to save us. Otherwise, it would not work.
Lies. Twisting the truth.
No. Truth is truth. And now we must play out the final act. It is time.
No!
If you perish, Captain, please accept our gratitude for trying. We know you gave it your all. Amplification begins now.
This is Executive Officer Holt Allen. I'm in Lab 4. You can pipe down the message. I'm all ready for it. Thank you.
This transmitted message is for Holt Allen. I'm Chief Medical Officer Aram Ross. First off, I want to apologize to you for not speaking with you in person, but we're dealing with a chaotic situation here. But to the point, I have some terrible news to give you, and I didn't want you to hear from anyone else first. There's been an incident at Tanabra Base. We don't have all the facts yet, but there was an accident involving one of our supply shuttles, and actually it was Natalie Robertson's shuttle. And I'm sorry to say she's gone. Natalie's dead. And I'm damn sorry. She was one of our best pilots. She was a wonderful person. We don't know much yet. Why the shuttle exploded, how many are unaccounted for, what went wrong. As soon as I get more information, of course, we'll let you know what's going on. Feel free to contact me anytime at the medical office at Tanabra Base. If you need help with any of the funeral arrangements or anything, well, just call. I'm so sorry, son.
So what's your next move, Holt?
I will honor her, Miles. I will honor her. You've been a good friend. I appreciate you being here.
Well, you were there for me not that long ago, as I recall.
I'm heading back to Starfleet. The Helena leaves in 6 hours. Apparently, I still have a few friends left. My old job awaits. You've been a good friend. If I ever get my own command, I'm taking you with me.
You've got it. When that time comes, give me the call.
It's not fair, Miles. Life is just not fair.
No, I suppose it's not, is it?
Listen, if you want, you could spend the night here.
I'll take you up on that offer, I think. Thank you. Alan to Helena. I'm ready to be beamed up.
Stand by, we'll have you in just a second.
Affirmative. I will always love you. Always.
Enough energy to escape. We are saved. Setting course for sun orbit.
Can you come to the bridge, please?
Bridge, this is the captain. Mr. Tzrak.
Aye, sir.
I suppose everyone is wondering right now why the sun is reading normal again. I have the answer. I want all department heads to meet me in the conference room in 15 minutes.
Of course, sir.
And Mr. Tzrak. I'll have no proof, but what a tale my thoughts will tell.
Welcome to Critical Not Cynical. I am Big J. I'm here with Vance, Frank, and our special guest, George Kahan, who was the star, actor, writer, director, leader of the film you just watched or listened to, Star Trek Antilles, Episode 6. I was kind of worried when Vance put this one up as the one we were going to watch, because the first thing I thought was, number six, well, I'm not going to know what's going on because there's all the episodes prior, which I didn't want to not watch them, but I did just do number six to focus on that one just in case, we go back and do the others. But I was thinking to myself, well, great, Vance is putting me at a disadvantage because I'm sure these guys have seen all of them. And am I going to know what's going on? And George, we were talking just a little bit ago that some of these episodes you are trying to make it to where they're episodic, but with like serialized undertones so that you're not, if someone jumps in, they're not completely lost. But why don't I let you take over that part and just tell our audience your thought process behind the series, when it started, how many there are, so forth.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me and this esteemed panel. I'm definitely among friends. It's actually a pretty straightforward concept. And I've said this to Frank and Vance many times. I like to think of my series as a book and that each episode represents a chapter. It's a risk when something is this serialized, because obviously people might stumble upon the series later in the series and then feel like what you just said, which is, I don't quite know what's going on. So that was the original game plan. And I had to make a decision. I either stick with that or don't. And I said back in 2013, when I came up with my show, that's what I'm going to do. And hopefully people will be interested enough and follow it through. My thought process is sort of Trek and soap opera in the idea that these characters are going to achieve certain things, go through certain things, but there's got to be some sort of mystery. You don't want to give the audience everything up front, because, you know, then what are you going to do for the rest of your show? So at the same time, you can't keep them hanging so long that they lose interest. So a lot of these episodes, particularly in the last half of the show, there's going to be 30 episodes altogether. We're up to episode 24 now, so we really are heading into the home stretch. And at this point, all the way up to the finale, a lot of the answers are coming. I'm going to reward my long-term viewers, and I want the last two-parter for my finale to be literally the playing out of the entire storyline. I just want the audience to relax, go with the action, and have these characters, you know, play out what I set up, you know, so long ago. So I'm not here to trick the audience. I'm not here to, you know, make them suffer. But things have to happen naturally. And I'll give you an example. My original run was only 20 episodes. And then I met Vance Major. And I suddenly had a plethora of new characters. And it wasn't a case of derailing me. It was a case of now adding to it. So I said, you know what? I'm going to need an extra 10 episodes to have Vance, you know, be part of this and then get back on track to, you know, what I had started originally.
It's like when you're playing
with derailing. I know Vance.
It's like when you're playing a video game and you're like, okay, I got to get to the castle. I've got to save the princess. And then you wander in a village and you're like, oh, a side quest. And that's what I would, you know, that's what I would say George and I did. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
The thing I liked about episode 6 in particular, more than George's other films. And I haven't seen all of George's films. I've seen most of them, but I mean, I know how people feel about my films when they're like, there's just so many of them, Vance. And that's how I feel about George's films. So I'm like, hey, I don't think I've seen this one, George. And I pride myself on thinking I've seen them all. And then George would be like, hey, what about this one? I'm like, I don't think I've seen that one. But the thing I like about episode 6 in particular is it's almost like an origin story for your character. Like you get... Yeah, and I love that one because it's a great jumping on point. And like you said, Big J, you don't know anything about the story, but you watch this one, and you're like, oh, okay, phew, I don't have to worry about the quote-unquote baggage that may have come before, which a lot of these fan films have, you know, when they're that far into their series. But you feel you watch right on in, and you're like, okay, now I know these characters. And then going forward, you're like, man, this is great. And then watching anything that came before is just like, man, this is almost a prequel to what you have. And that's the thing I love about George's films is they're very approachable in every aspect. And I love the fact that when you're watching the films, it may not be the, you know, glossed over, razzle dazzle special effects, but you watch it and you're like, man, this is something that you can make on a nice budget. You know, the alien creature, for instance, you know, I love the fact that it's like a gray alien mask and like some aluminum foil. Like I'm sitting there going, that's fucking creative. God dang it. Why haven't I thought of that? You know, it's so great. And George plays everything. He plays everything straight, you know, and I dig that, you know. And I think it's, you know, although the Avalon stuff is nice and the Axanar stuff is nice, I tend to gravitate more toward George because it's stuff that he really thinks outside the box when he's like, man, I need a cool looking alien. And I don't have CGI and I don't have, you know, all this fancy schmancy. What do I have? Man, you know, let me go to
I have foil.
Oh, I got. Yeah, there you go. And I dig that, you know, and I would recommend George's stuff for anybody that's looking to make a fan film on a budget. Because you go to like classic Twilight Zone, and those are great stories. And to today's standards, they may not hold up special budget wise, but those stories are great. And looking at George's stuff, his stories are just as good as like an Avalon story or Axanar or anyone's. Hell, even mine. Like, I mean, that's, and it was such a pleasure to collaborate with George once we get to there, you know, because he's such a creative guy. You know, it's just like working with Frank. Once you start, you know, boom, 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 it's just firing on all cylinders. And it's great to see these earlier films because it's like, man, this is where he came from, you know. I dig it on so many levels, man. It's such a great film.
Thank you so much, Vance. I'll give you guys an exclusive here, a little stuff that nobody else knows, because
I like
what
it.
You said. Now, when it came time to write for the aliens in this episode, I wanted something very different and something like hopefully like a psychologically terrifying thing. And what I did was I had built the alien out of clay originally, and I tried stop motion with it. And the stop motion was taking really a long time, because even with the animation done, I'd have to like mat it into place, and it was getting very, very complicated because it was going to be a lot of screen time. So ultimately I did some animation tests on it and said, you know what, I want to go with something more practical, something that feels a little bit more in the room with it. And the funny thing is, even though ultimately it turns out to be foil and a mask, in order to get that look, I actually built a set around it, which was kind of like a version of the room that the captain finds himself in.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I had to carefully lock down the camera so I could mesh the two images together without, you know, any kind of motion. The tricky thing for me doing the live action stuff was where to keep my eye, because I had to imagine how big this alien was and try to be consistent with that. So ultimately the alien was, I shot it with four different filters. So I would go into my editing program and blast out the color, put in another, I really wanted to solarize it to make it look that much more alien. And the head was actually manipulated with a set of rods that ran up the main structure of the body. So I could tug on the rods and then the mask could, you know, do that. You know, it was kind of neat, you know. Originally, I wanted to use my hand, but I could not get it through what the alien was made out of. So it's simple, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of thinking that goes into the alien, you know, what happens with it, you know. I also wanted to show something that hopefully you guys hadn't seen before, because that's the fun part. I know Frank does this, Vance does this. You always want to have something about your episode that makes it unique, so it doesn't feel like it's following, you know, just another pattern. And I'll be completely honest with you, having no budget is where I'm very happy. I've been offered a lot of money. People said, oh, just open up a Patreon or whatever, and we'll throw money. I don't want that. I don't want it. I'll give you two of my trade secrets. One, consistency. If you watch my first episode, you know what you're in for all the way up to episode 30. So you either will like it and get involved with that world, or you'll say, no, it's not for me, and that's fine. I'm never going to do an episode where it's like $40 million budget, nothing, you know, because what happens is the audience gets jittery. The audience goes, I don't know what to expect, and that's not necessarily a good thing. They'll look at your episode and they'll be like, I don't know what to expect.
Right.
I want them to feel comfortable. When they see my bridge, I want it to feel like their living room. I want them to be comfortable with whatever I'm presenting them.
Well, it gives the audience a lot more, and when I say audience, I mean just general public. It gives them the freedom to then nitpick, because they look at one episode, which may be, you know, the general episode, and then they see the $40 million budget you have, and they're like, oh, I love this. And then they see the again, you know, scrapping for wooden nickels in your couch cushion episode, and they're like, well, I fucking want that one. Where the hell did the budget go? And that allows them the freedom to complain. Whereas if you're consistent, you're like, hey man, I've always had those wooden nickels, and that's what I paste on the wall, you know. And that's the one thing that I enjoy about your films is, again, like I said, I've always recommended your films for, hey, if you want to know how to make a film on the low, go watch this guy's films because he's very creative. Because I love watching your films and looking at the backgrounds. And I've said this a dozen times, so forgive me for those audience members who are like, God, I've heard him say this over and over and over. But I respect the hell out of you because you, just looking at your backgrounds, I love it. Because, you know, you look at it and you see like the, you know, you're like, I've seen that at the Dollar Tree, or I've seen that at the dollar store. Or that's just some wire tubing. And you're like, why didn't I think of that? And then you're like, man, how can I take that and go make it my own? And it's like that, you and I've discussed that. And you're like, that's what I want to do. I want to inspire people. And I love that, because that makes me want to go inspire people as well. And it's, you don't need a ton of money to do that. You just need to think outside that box. And I love that, because you were doing that when no one else was paying attention on YouTube. You were just doing it to have fun. And that's what Star Trek, I think, should be about.
That's the thing that I really enjoy about people like George and you and me, is the fact that we're doing it for fun. And yeah, we're having a good time doing it. And like Vance was saying, one of my big points, you know, what I was going to say is, and he brought it up, is I love the consistency. Not only do I love the consistency, I am amazed and thrilled that you've been able to keep the same cast since 2013, because that is a hard thing to do.
Yes.
I don't think you've had that much of a cast change. I think almost everybody you started with is still with you.
Yeah.
Loyalty, and that you guys are having fun and you're doing something as a family.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because that is one of the biggest challenges, is getting people to, not that they don't want to do it, but do they have the time to do it? And right. What I'm pretty good at is, if someone says, look, I won't be able to do this after a certain point, I'm able to look ahead to my scripts and then spend a dedicated day of filming a particular character. And right now there's two or three cast members. Yeah, I have two or three cast members that no longer live in the United States. They got married, they had kids, they moved on. Really? Yeah. But because I have mapped this whole story out, I'm able to take a piece that I shot 5 or 6 years ago and easily put it in as needed, because it became very, very necessary to do that. But yeah, my actors would say, listen, I'm getting married, I'm moving to Canada, I'm not going to be around. So that's the one thing I'm pretty good at, and good at, you know, organizing and saying, okay, if you're going to leave, let's wrap your character up and I'll shoot about 30, 40 hours worth of footage to be parceled out later.
The other thing that I really enjoy about your stuff is you still do it on that mini DVD.
That's the consistency, Frank, because
yeah, I know
my mini DVD would change. Like if I suddenly shot in a 4K, you know, or massive, it would look very, very different. And the thing I love about mini DV is, not to get too technical, but I love the color saturation, the frame rate noise. I love the way the picture looks. It takes a little bit off the edges, and yet it's still clear enough. And you can upscale it if you really wanted to.
It looks good, but it just, I always get a mini DVD, and I'm going, man.
It reminds me. JD Customs. He does these custom action figures, and Royce has been in two of his commercials now. One is coming, I think, well, by the time this airs, it comes out on the 22nd. So whenever this airs, I think it'll be like in a few days. But he's been in one of his commercials, which came out, I think, January, and then the other one will be out on March 22nd.
Nice.
The one that comes out on the 22nd, I saw a sneak peek. And it was funny because he does the because he customizes retro Playmate action figures, Star Trek action figures. And Royce had a voiceover in the first one. And the second one, I actually got him in costume, and he's pretending to play with them and whatnot, and doing action poses and whatnot, and sharpening his acting skills there. But it was funny because the start of the video, you hear the sound of like a VCR tape going into VCR, and you see the kind of scraggly lines that VCRs used to have, and the effects of like a VCR, like the SLP on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love it because it had that nostalgia factor, you know, but at the very, like maybe 2 or 3 seconds of the commercial start, you see those things. And it's like, it's an instant nostalgia. Kids nowadays wouldn't know what that means, but for you, for all of us here, we would know what that means. And watching how you talk about staying in a certain fragment of making the films is the same type of vibe that I get when I saw that. It's the same type. And I know just looking at a film, you know, a few segments of it, I can be like, oh, that's a George Kayan film, just because of how it's shot and how it's done. And Avalon films are the same way, just because of how crisp and how things are shot a certain way. It's like I can look at it and go, oh, I know where that's from. And not a lot of films are like that. I can tell when it's a Vance film because I don't need to visually see it. I can just listen and be like, oh, he said brother and he's talking about pizza rolls. That's a Vance film, you know. So I can tell it. But not a lot of films are recognizable.
Or you hear a lot of this.
A lot of wind blowing.
yeah. I'm known for that. Yeah, I'm not very good on audio. But your films, George, are recognizable just in that you stay in your own sandbox and you don't want to be bigger than what you are. You know exactly what you want to be and you're happy with that. And I dig that because it's like that allows accessibility to, hey, Joe, why don't you come over here and be in my film? Hey, Frank, why don't you come be in my film? Hey, anybody, come be part of this. And it's just so accessible because it is accessible. It lends itself to that. And it's really, really cool.
I appreciate you saying that, Vance. I really do. You know, it's funny watching your films. I swear to God, if you and I lived like a mile apart, we would have been on the same course because by the time I found you, I'm like, this guy is me. He's just me in a different location.
I wouldn't have left Vance films when I did and then come back if I had met Vance at that point in time. I'll tell you. One of the things I really want to say about yours, and unlike Vance, I have seen all your films. But I like your writing. I like the depth that you put into your characters, especially you've got a lot of philosophy in your films, in your writing. And I love that. Even in this film, even though it's one of the earlier ones and you're not getting into what you're into now, you know, it's always that deepness that you write into your films. I've never seen anything really surface. It's always been deep. And I really like that a lot about your writing.
Frank, thank you. I really appreciate that. I made a concerted effort. Philosophy is one of my true loves. Astronomy, philosophy, the inherent drama. Whenever I write a screenplay, and I'm sure, Vance, you probably feel the same way, it's the story ultimately, yes, very important. But could it be performed in front of a curtain with just two characters chatting away? Will the concept hold? If it passes that test, if the idea is good enough and you have actors that you trust, then you're okay. Everything else is window dressing, which is why I don't overly worry about, you know, the other elements of my show. So I really try to make it a point to be faithful to Star Trek, obviously. The original series. But yeah, the philosophy, it does come from me. The writing is, I mean, these characters, I mean, I'm not anything like Holt Allen in real life where this man can fearlessly travel. I have a fear of traveling. I will stay home any chance I get. I'm not a I'm the opposite. This guy is not afraid of anything. That's not true of me at all. You know, but playing the character, you have to believe it. And so getting all those inner thoughts out under the prism of who that character is a thrill, you know? And it's funny because sometimes I worry that, oh, did I get too deep into the philosophical? Will anyone want to follow this? But the good news is most people watch the show and they're on board. You know,
have you heard that a lot? Do people pick up on that?
Yeah. Yeah. I had a professor at one of the colleges out here on Long Island, and he's like, I teach philosophy. And he's like, I show your episodes to my students.
Does he really?
Wow. Now that is woo.
That's big.
That's really cool. And then he asked my permission if my my email, if the students want to ask me anything directly, could they write me? And I said, sure, you know, fine. So every now and then I get a nice question. And it's cool because it's another generation. And, you know, much, you know, I'm over 60. And then having a 20-year-old say, well, what's the certain? Yeah, yeah, youngster. No, I try very hard. Here's my thing. My thing is I don't treat my audience in a bad way. I'm assuming if you're watching my show, you have a certain level of intelligence. I don't want to spoon feed you too much. Yes, I will give you the answer eventually, but you've had plenty of time to kind of figure it out yourself. And then you know, you can listen to my answer and see whether you're right or wrong. But I love to treat my audience intelligently, and that's why I'm very dialogue heavy. I know it's not like the way to go with today's attention spans. A lot of people, they really, really want, you know, one, two, three, go.
Mm-hmm. But they want to see that flash bang. They don't want to hear dialogue. You know,
yeah.
I've had people say, you don't have enough action. Well,
yeah,
we don't have enough action is because we're more of a story.
Cerebral.
We want you to think. We don't want to say, if you want to watch it and you know, watch it for just background noise, that's fine. You're going to lose what we are trying to do. But hey, those who watch understand.
One of the fun things with joining forces with Vance was his character, Menard, was so wonderfully complimentary to my character. Like, we play friends in the show. And the cool thing was I was able to expand the mystery by asking Menard, hey, can you find out something? And then he's like, well, I'll get back to you. And then when he came back to me, it now forwards the story. It's very important that every bit you reveal forwards your story. And then what happened is, you know, we joined forces. And then, of course, it finally all played out in episode 20. And Vance did a tour de force acting job in that, playing the Phantom and Good Menard. Just unbelievable. Anyone hasn't seen that. That is an acting tour de force. But then there comes a point where, you know, by now that I'm on to my last, you know, five or six episodes, the original purpose was basically to have Captain Allen and the crew of the Antilles be like basically alone to face all this. And if I had Menard with me, I couldn't lose. I mean, the guy, you know, he's so awesome. And, you know, if I had the Constar right there. And it's true for like what my friend Kenneth Thomas, he plays for the captain of the Saladin, you know, Ray Martin. I couldn't have anyone else come along at this point in the journey. So, you know, structurally, it's like, it's perfectly great to have as many allies as you can. And then by the time you get near the end of the show, the audience has got to feel the peril. You know, I mean, I love all of you guys, and I would have all you guys all together all the time.
But this is your story. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, if the audience doesn't feel the threat, if they don't feel like, oh, these guys are on their own, my payoff won't, I won't be able to do that. You know, that initial payoff.
But well, it's like if Voyager was contacting Starfleet every other episode in season one. The thing that I love about your films, besides the philosophy, because obviously there's a lot there to digest in what you're trying to present. I don't need to see Holt Allen, you know, swashbuckling and jumping through castles, you know, illusion castles, and fighting all these rock monsters and whatnot. There's always the romanticism of that adventure there. There's always the talk of the adventure. And because you sell that point all the time, and there is a discussion of philosophy and the what ifs, and because you have done the creative, the aliens that you have done, instead of just off the screen conversations or, hey, look at that over there. And then nothing on the screen, you know, because you've done such a wonderful job of crafting the universe that you have and the small portions that you've done, it gives you just a taste of wanting to see more. And the job you've done of like, say, your ship, you and I both know that it's your parents' basement.
Yeah.
Is it?
Now it is. For many years, it was the other apartment, but then we had to move. Yeah.
How many places have you actually shot in?
Three, Frank. There was my parents' house originally. Right. And I had a lot more room in that basement. I had like the full basement. Then right. we moved to another town and I had a very little space, and I was actually matting in the smaller sets into bigger matte painting, okay. you know, to expand it.
Right.
And then we were forced to move and I'm back at my parents' house now. But unfortunately, I only have half the space of yeah, what I used to all back in.
Yeah. When Vance finished, I do have a question for you when, sure. when he finished with what he's saying.
But looking at your bridge, it's the perfect way to show, like, this is how you do it. Like, if you don't have green screen, this is how you do it appropriately. This is how you use the space effectively. And it's not, as I've said before, it's not what you actually have. It's what the camera sees. It's the angle yeah. you present things. And it's so crafty because it's basically, okay, we're going to shoot this from this angle. And then, okay, let's move this around. Let's do this. And you're still got the same background, but it's just changing perception and angles and making it appear as if it's one giant room, although it's shot smaller. And it gives it more of a submarine type vibe, or small science vessel type vibe. And I like that. I really do. It makes me want to go visit that, even though I know it'd be like, you know, you walk in, you're like, wow.
Banshee, your okay, head would hit the ceiling. Your yeah, head yeah, would hit the ceiling on my
You
head.
And I have talked about that. How you and I have talked about that, about how, like, we both have used cardboard sets, about how we tape to the, how, like, if you step back 1 foot, you would see the tape, like, yeah. reaching yeah. up to the ceiling, and about how if you bump it accidentally, like, it would fall down on us. Like, yeah. we both have yeah. had that problem. And we take the pictures to make it look nice and make it look like, hey, guys, we've got our shit together. But, like, if you tap it, like, boom, it falls on us.
Yeah. The way the bridge is actually shaped now, it's like if you could look down on the basement from aerial yeah. view, it looks like a horseshoe.
There's okay. Because yeah. it was square for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it is square. But what happens is because of the basement space, I have to kind of round off the corners by using yeah, fake right. walls. Yeah, it is still square because, I mean, I couldn't really get around it. I tried really hard. The thing is, the room is so limiting that I yeah. have to maximize the squareness of the space because sometimes the camera can't get far enough away. That's why I don't really have a lot of establishing shots. But from the 2013 footage, I had more room. So anytime you see the full main view screen
right.
and the helmsman, yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. I don't have that room anymore. So all that's my stock footage that I've been saving. And then I'll look up my record and say, okay, I haven't used that yet. Haven't used that yet. But there's two sides, there's two walls, and there is a temporary turbo, you know, the elevator, the turbo lift, but it can't be part of where it normally would belong.
Right, so right.
Separate. It's like if you first come downstairs into the basement space, it's by itself. So anytime right. yeah, because just, I can't attach it anymore.
Yeah, just cheating the shots on
I
it.
To, yeah.
You know, the thing that I... Getting back to what Vance was saying about that submarine feel, and that's exactly what we're trying to do now with the bridge.
Right.
The reason we've darkened the gray and stuff like that and moved it in, I wanted to get more of what I feel, even though it's a Star Trek set, space flight is going to be more confined. It's not going to be these wide, you know, bridges and stuff like that. I mean, air consumption, number one.
Yeah.
But the fact is, that's what, you know, that tightness, we're going to have establishing shots, but I wanted to feel that submarine type of feeling because that I feel is more realistic in the long run
yeah.
to do it that way.
Well, I got to tell you, Frank, your thinking and what Vance does is the psychological subtext. So yeah. a lot of times, particularly like in my episode 3, I shot almost exclusively close-ups because I wanted claustrophobia. I wanted the feeling of being trapped. Now, hopefully the audience doesn't think like, you don't want the audience to know that trick. You want them to get that feeling. So right. sometimes someone will write to me and says, oh, you didn't do a lot of establishing shots. And I'll say, well, it was sort of designed that way. I could only get so far anyway. And then the other thing, and I'm sure you guys have all gone through this, there's not a lot of days where everyone is available. And so ultimately you have to say, okay, I'm only going to be able to shoot from this angle and this angle on another day and put it all together. I try very hard to get people together, but man, real life, it just will mess up your plans. And yeah. Ultimately it's like, I could still tell the same story just with separate cuts. Believe me, I would love a day where, like, you know, you have 20 people sitting on the bridge. It's just not feasible.
No, we're not professionals, so that's the limitation. And you yeah. do, you know, when we shot Rebirth, or no, the one I think before Rebirth, we were supposed to have extra people on the bridge, and we didn't. So yeah. we had to kind of sneak Donna in to be when she technically was on the planet. But yeah. she was still sitting on the bridge. So, you know, you have to make those concessions.
You really do. One of the things I fell for Vance's film so much was this kindred spirit. Because before I actually met Vance, I was watching his work. And suddenly I'm like, this guy is me. You know, it's like he's approaching the work and he's working with what he has. But what always won me over with Vance was his storytelling. Yours too, Frank. I love your characters. And characters are the backbone.
He's my writer, George. Just remember that.
So, I mean, ultimately, you want – I mean, I've gotten some really nice compliments from people that never met me where they actually were emotionally moved, you know, by the characters. Uh-huh. And that's more than you can hope for when you have no budget. So you got to hope that they like the characters enough to, you know, care about them.
It goes back to your storytelling, the way you approach yeah. it. And that's a very big compliment on you. And yeah. that didn't look like Vance. Okay, I'm going to sneak this in. George, I have yeah. to ask. The first episode, not the first episode, the first series you did was with yeah. your mom. Now, whose idea was this all? How did you get started?
Okay, the very first thing I actually did was a little comedy short called The Real McCoy. I don't know if you have ever seen it.
No, I haven't seen that one, no.
Okay, real quick story, because I don't want to bore you guys, but I think it was ABC was holding a funniest video contest, and I was unaware of this, but they actually said on air, wouldn't it be funny if you guys do a Star Trek short? Just do something Star Trek related, and if you win, you get a spot on our show. And remember, this is before the internet.
So this would be before CBS was after you.
yeah, it was a very long time ago, but TV shows were drawing in big ratings. So my brother called me up and said, George, I know you love Star Trek. I love Star Trek. We got to shoot a video short and then get it on. We could win something and get on, you know, TV. I said, okay, well, how much time do we have? And he goes, we have 7 hours to get this thing done and into the mail, or else it won't make it. I was like, what? You know, I was shooting another one of my films called Murder Will Out. And the thing is, I love Star Trek so much that if you gave me enough time, I would actually cut my hair like Captain Kirk, because it was going to be, it had to be a Star Trek, something that people knew. So, yeah, well, so what happened was I couldn't cut my hair for continuity. I had this really long mullet that was for my character. And I was like, I said to my brother, I said, I'll try to part my hair. Back in those days, I had very, very thick, curly hair. I said, I'll try to make it look like Kirk, but I can't cut my hair. There's nothing I can do about it. He's like, don't worry about it. It's a parody. Like, you know, who cares? I said, all right, fine. So back in those days, this wasn't even mini DV. This was a VHS giant over the shoulder camera that, you know, that I bought in the late 1980s. And so we literally were working on the script, and the script had giant gaps in it for improvisation as long as we got to the next part of the story. Called my one of my really good friends, who in real life is a real physicist. I said, you got to play Spock. You just know science and, you know. And I said, I'll play Captain Kirk, and then my brother will play the Klingon commander. That's all the cast was going to be. Eventually, we added Dr. McCoy. So we're building the set. And remember, there was no prep time. So I'm going around the basement. I arranged our couch to look like the panels, like what you got in your bridge, you know, just to give it that vibe. I used a word processor. I used stickers. And it barely looked like a bridge at all, but enough. And then we just filmed it. We filmed it straight. And back in those days, we didn't even have editing. Did you know all the sound effects that are in that short are actually an album of Star Trek sound effects played on a record live?
I remember doing that for theater, going out and getting the rumbling of the cars and stuff like that on record.
Yeah. So we knew that we had 20 seconds until, say, like, I don't know, the turbo lift would open up, and we didn't want that. So boom, you know, so we were doing it live, and thank God we all knew each other a long time. We did it. My brother had already built the Trek models, so we had filmed them. We did a rough cut and gave it to my friend Dave to do like a final polish, and off it went. And we didn't win, but we got honorable mention. But we didn't get shown on
TV. I gotta see this. Is it up on your channel?
It's up on my channel. It's called The Real McCoy.
And
what happened was, one thing that might confuse you, Frank, is you're going to see two versions of me in it. So what happened was, I had filmed Dr. McCoy and Kirk at the same time, you know, changing my hair a little bit. But that footage got very badly damaged over the years. So the version that's on my YouTube channel, I just re-recorded my McCoy part with the way I look back in 2011.
Yeah,
I filmed it and just put it back in its place. And it works even better because I look so different that it really looks like another actor is playing McCoy. So it really worked out good.
That's just like Joe Cepeda having, who was it now? I can't think of him. Anyways, he was they were filming it. He kept on
Larry changing. Larry Fleming.
Yeah.
So they had to write that into the story. But I can see that. So, okay. So you went from there. How did you get your mother involved? And I think that's the most interesting.
Yeah. That's not a problem. I love telling the story but it's not an event, like a crazy story, you know. But basically what happened was when I, let me just give you the full setup. And everyone knows this that has ever asked. This is not a secret, but a lot of people, when they see my first Star Trek movie, they say it sounds a lot like this novel. I don't remember the title of it, but it seems to, you know, be very similar. And I said, that's not a coincidence, because when I created the movie, there was no internet. I was making a movie just for me. And I had come up with a short story called Starship Lost, okay, which is with the Captain Navarro character, who was a man originally, and all these other characters. And then I said, well, if I'm going to take the trouble to make a Star Trek movie, and I don't even know if I can do this, I want to base it on my favorite novel. But I didn't have one favorite novel. So I literally lined up like 30 paperbacks of all my Star Trek novels I had at the time, threw a quarter blindly over my shoulder, and I said, wherever that quarter lands, that will be my Star Trek, you know, movie. And it landed on something called Something Chain. Not Infinite Chain, that was the title of my film. Endless Chain or something, I don't know. No, Chain of Attack, that's it. Chain of Attack. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use the bulk of the story from this novel and my Starship Lost, because the original novel was Captain Kirk and crew. And there was a whole other section I was never going to do in the book. But I love the core idea of the story. So I married the two. And I made my own original screenplay. But if you look at the opening and closing credits, it gives full credit to the original author of the novel, the title of it. You know,
the normal things we do.
Yeah, it was no secret. It's so funny. Sometimes I get accused, like somebody will watch my film now. Hey, that's just like that book, as if it's a big secret. I'm like, no, it's not a secret. It's in the credits. It's, you know. But remember, I literally was making this movie just for me. But the Captain Navarro was originally a male character, and I auditioned some actors. I had gone to Hofstra College where they had an acting program. I put my cast notice up. We actually rented out a room. We had about 100 people show up for the role, which was great. It took all day, but no one was right for the role. They were either too old or too young or didn't know Star Trek, you know, whatever reason, cutting to the chase. And one day I'm sitting in the kitchen and I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll make the captain a woman. I don't know. So I need to change this up. And my mom was cooking in the kitchen and she got me involved in Star Trek originally. So because she was watching it and I was a baby, but I was watching it from the get-go. So while mom was cooking, I said, hey, mom, would you be interested in maybe doing the voice of the computer, you know, for my Star Trek movie? And she goes, yeah, I could do that. I can definitely do that. I said, okay, great. And then from that moment on, in the back of my mind, I'm like, you know, she's the right age. She knows Star Trek like the back of her hand. Maybe. But then I started auditioning other actresses. And again, same situation, too old, too young, never a good fit. I went back to mom. And I said, mom, would you be interested
in me, mom?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, she was working full time and I was worried that this movie would sit squarely on her shoulders. And she's like, oh, I don't know. I said, well, do me a favor. I said, I have a costume for you. Just throw on the shirt. Keep your glasses on. Don't worry about that. Read right from the script, but just try to act like a captain. One page. So I set the camera up. She went downstairs. I had built the bridge at this point, but no captain. So Mom sat in the chair, and although she was script bound, she was nailing it. And at one point she put the script down and was just saying it. I'm like, huh? I said, Mom, if you want, the role is yours and I will work around your schedule. I will do everything to get you, you know. And she was amazing. She'd work all day, full time, come home at night, film all night with me. I mean, it was really beyond,
I enjoyed her as the captain, to be perfectly.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but it wasn't automatic, though, Frank. You know what I mean? It wasn't automatic. It wasn't like, oh, that's my mom. She got the role.
No. I didn't. I was just curious to see. I thought maybe she might have come up with the idea and said, hey, George, you do films. How about doing a star? You see, I wasn't sure how it worked.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So, you know.
But you know what? All her knowledge of Star Trek really came, she understood the technology. She understood the dialogue. The only thing that my mom, by nature, is very jovial. And I kept having to say to her, well, you know, the Navarro character, it's life or death here. She's not in a good mood, you know. And any humor she has, it's very dry sarcasm. So, yeah, we had a lot of takes where she would just crack up and laugh or smile, because that's her natural. And I'd say, no, Mom, we got to take it down. You know, you got to be, you know, and I would wear her out. And then I would end up using take 13, take 14 when she was just,
Stop freaking smiling.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that was it. I swear, if you were there, you would have heard that, you know. Because the problem with my mom is once she starts to laugh, you know, and get in a good mood, you can't stop her. You cannot stop her. So it was like, I had to kind of keep her like on edge, you know?
I love the fact that you guys have like three generations of filmmakers, from your mom to you to your daughter.
Yeah.
I mean, because you've gotten her into, what age was it when your daughter, Anya?
Yeah.
Was it Anya?
He started at six. Yep. Anya. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep wanting to say Ayana, but I'm like, no, that's the character she played in the, like, what?
Four. She was four when she started.
Four.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was pretty young, if I recall.
Yeah. She was four. She did kind of two standalones where it was like an alternate reality where she served on the ship, but even though she's a tiny little 4 year old. And she came up with the stories. I just tried to realize them, you know, according to her wishes. But then after that, she became behind the scenes. She's got a great eye and ear for continuity. She will actually tap me on the shoulder and said, no, he didn't move at that point. She really was invaluable. And she would also keep up to with the script. If any of my actors needed to pick up their line, she'd be right there to feed them the line. And then eventually we came up with Charm.
And that is a great character. Yeah.
Thank you. It was a risk though. I mean, it's a risk when you put someone in a mask. And the thing that Anya loved about it was it could account for her small stature, but because she's an alien, and because otherwise, it's hard to make the audience convinced that a starship would have such a young person, you know, in a major role.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Right.
I give it Sharp. Sharp could be this alien, and who cares what the size is? As a matter of fact, to me, it made it even better, the fact that she was tiny. You know, it made Sharp that much of a more powerful person. And since the mouth never moved, we came up with the universal translator bracelet. So the idea was you'd hear her telepathic thoughts as long as she used the bracelet every now and then. So it was a character.
That's one of the beauties of your creative process that you've gone through. Like, who else would have thought of that? They just would have had, you know, the person mimicking and who needs a mouth moving? Like, but you don't do that. You're like, oh no, let's telepathic. Let's have a little, like, it's those little attention to detail that like you do. And it's so appreciated from people like me. I love seeing stuff like that in the films and something as a generic mask that we've all seen. Because every once in a while, like, I'll see that mask pop up. Because I do browse masks, because as you know, I collect masks myself for my own films. And every once in a while, like, I'll see that mask and I'm like, oh, Sharb. You know, but
yeah, I like the one you have. I like the one you have on tonight, actually.
Shut up, Frank. There's a fighting words. Right. So I'm saying, why do I put up with this? This is why we need you, Big J. This is why we keep you here.
I was going to say earlier, George, he likes Holt. He hates Grissom.
Yeah. See, Holt is my friend. This is why you're my friend, George, and you know, Frank there. But
I'm a fan of Grissom, though.
But the like the Sharp character, like, you've turned, you know, a simple Halloween mask into something where, like you said, the little stature of Sharb, you know, it's a cute little alien, like the little alien that follows Scotty around on in the J.J. Abrams movies. Like, it's I associate those two characters like a lot alike, because it's like the short little character that follows Holt around, and it's, you're the plucky sidekick, you know, and that to me, you know, I don't even see the actress, I see the character, you know, and that. You know, again, just a simple Halloween mask. That's awesome. And like you said, the, you know, telepathic thing. Who does that? You know,
but her those hand gestures all the time. I like her.
That's
hand
all her, Frank. Honestly, Anya understands the scene. She'll get the lines in her head. Just to, we have a guide. She does. She determines on how Sharp moves, and I love it because I don't have to tell her.
She's great. Know?
Yeah, I mean,
she can throw you out of the picture, and she
the worst I have to tell her, the worst, and it's rare, is sometimes she'll like say over gesture, right? And I'll say, okay, just take it down a notch, only because Sharp is not upset, you know, like, just keep it just a little bit more. You can still gesture, and then I do the voice for Sharp, so I overdub. Oh.
Yes, I do the voice for Sharp. I didn't know that. That's really good.
Well, it's not just my voice doing that. I also reverb it, and I slow it down a little bit. But it's fun to talk like Sharp, you know? So, but she loves it because it takes the pressure off her.
Yeah,
but she
still knows.
Yeah,
it lets her focus on the physicality and something that she's able to get more confidence in, and that's, I see, as you know. You know that I've acted with Royce, and he's stepping into where she's stood before, you know, on getting into the acting part. And I love the fact that you're allowing her to excel where she has excelled, you know, behind the camera, getting into the physicality of acting, whatnot. I dig that on so many levels, man. That is so cool that you get to share that with your daughter. One of the things, and I'm going to be a little, shut the door here. One of the things, and I'm going to be a little selfish on the talk time here for a second. One of the things that I don't think I've thanked you enough in private, but I'm going to take the time to do it publicly. In The Pretender, I got to write for Anya as that mirror universe version, the daughter of Mirror Holt.
Right.
And I loved being able to do that, because it got to seeing her. I very much saw reflections of, in a couple of years, this is going to be Royce. This is going to be more my son. And I love acting with him. And I'm getting to do that now with the father son project of Constar. I'm seeing those parallels, and it's one of the things where you and I, not many people get to do what you and I have done on so many levels, where the low budget, the getting to film with our kids, the getting to film just for us and fuck the world, you know? And that's one reason why, like, it can be 6 months between conversations and we pick right back up to where, you know, we left off. Right. I absolutely love your family, and I love your films. You are Starfleet in every sense of the word, from your philosophy to your filmmaking. Just you are a wonderful individual. I'm so glad that you have done what you've done, because honestly, I would not be where I'm at if it wasn't for you, because you are such an inspiration to so many of us.
Well, you know, I feel the same way about you, Vance, and your family. Again, we're kindred
spirits. Hear that, Frank?
No, it's, you know, You know what's really weird, and you're going to go through this now, Vance, is it's your time. Anya's starting to grow. She's never going to be tall, but she's now almost equal in height to me now. And one of the problems I have when she plays Sharp now is, do we address it? You know, her body's developing. She's 14 now, and all the things that come with that. But I said, you know what? We don't know anything about Sharp's biology. It, you know, just because things look a certain way doesn't mean it has to be that. So because I only got 5 episodes basically left in my show, I don't care that Sharp is taller now or whatever. I'm still getting to film, but I'm laughing because I know Royce is going to go through the same thing, you know, and your kid's going to go, yeah, one height to, you know.
Well, next. It's funny. We started the beginning of Constar the Motion Picture, and he was just missing like one tooth. And now, like, because his baby teeth are falling out, and his big teeth are falling. And now I'm like, well, let's wait a month or so. Right now he's got like a big old gap for like right here of like 2 teeth missing and 1 tooth here. And I'm like, you look like, because he was like, Dad, can we film? I'm like, dude, you look like a jack-o'-lantern. We're not filming shit right now. No, we're staying away from it. It looks like I just gave you the Mike Tyson punch out. I'm not doing nothing. No way.
But you've now filmed with Royce at that age that he'll never be, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then
you
continue to. So, I mean, at the time, it's like, yeah, I want to film with my family. Great. But the benefits are now you've kind of like documented the most.
Well, he's time. Well, he's asked me, because you remember the scene where Menard picks Eobard off the ground. You know, he's running through the, and he's like, and he's seen, because now we have a shed where Menard picked him up off the planet. And he asked me, he's like, so did you really find? He's like, did you really find me on the ground? I'm like, no, Royce. And I explained to him, I was like, no, Royce. Just right off the road there. I was like, no, Royce. And I explained to him how I filmed it. I was like, you were never actually on the ground, son. I wouldn't do that to you. You know, your mom might leave me on the ground after too many pizzas, but, you know, we never left you on the ground.
It is, Vance, is okay. The firstborn you don't put on the ground. Second and third, they dirt.
There you go.
Yeah, it all bets are off.
But no, you're absolutely right. Like we're not only making good stories for the fans, but we're documenting our history. And then when we pass, our family has that, and that's something that's always there for them. Yeah, it's not only a legacy for Trek, but a legacy for our family and something that's, hey, we did that. And that's something that it's a bond no one else can share, you know?
I mean, a lot of times when we film our show, and Jefferson, I'm sure, knows this too, every fan filmmaker has their own set of parameters, their own family, their own set of friends.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, by involving people in it, it becomes precious as time goes on. Because in the moment, it's like, oh, I'm working with who I got in my life. But then sometimes people pass, you know, as time goes on, these things become more precious and you realize I could never recreate what I had back then. Yeah. And I've been making films long enough that in every one of my film projects, I've lost someone. And it's very strange because for the longest time, all my actors were alive, you know, but now every one of my films has suffered a loss. And some of it's been family, some of it's been, you know, very close friends. And there's a new value added onto the films now that weird value that you're glad you did it while you did it. And so you can't put a price on something like that. I'm just happy that if I come up with an idea and I say to Vance, let's film something, you know, or Frank or any of my family and friends that, you know, God help them, they're in my, you know, immediate orbit. Yeah. I'm lucky enough that they say, all right, you're a nut. Let's do it. You know, it means something to you.
You're part of the reason why we have this umbrella of good natured people. Because when I came into fan films, it was not this way. It very much was people being cutthroat, people jabbing people to try to be on top. And you're not that way. And I'm not that way. Frank's not that way. If it was not for people like you doing it first, leading the way, because you've been doing it longer.
Even before me.
He's been doing it. He's been doing it since before anyone. You know, again, he's been doing it since the 90s, holding that big, you know, you know, backbreaker on the, you know, I mean, hell, he had the mullet. I mean, come on, guys. You know, come on, you know. I mean, he had the mullet before Menard did. Come on, guys, you know.
Well, that was 1990. So you could say my first thing, yeah, like 1990 was, you know, it was when it, the very first thing that I did Trek-wise. And yeah. Stopped since.
Yeah. No, and that's, and that, that to me, it's like we really would not be here if it wasn't for you. So, but quick question before we end everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would like to do at least once. I would like to do once a month, watch a film. Would you be able to come back once a month and do these bullshit sessions with us and chit chat fan film?
I love all you guys and yeah, I would gladly do that. I mean, it's fun for me to share the work, you know, and with such esteemed company. Come on, that's an offer I can't refuse.
Good,
but and we appreciate that. That would be great.
Jefferson's here.
I just like listening to you guys. There's nothing wrong with that. It, you know,
I'm sorry, Jefferson, we didn't let you get a word in edgewise.
That is okay. It balances out because there are times where it's like you know, I may be talking a lot, Vance, Frank. So it's just as you look at everything as a whole, it balances out. And I do enough talking as it is, so I've got.
And I think you're at that stage too, where you're beginning to hear more and more like George and stuff that you don't know the personal story. So the three of us have been together for so long that we can talk about these things and you're absorbing all this. So
yes.
This is also bringing you, you know, closer to the fold. So.
And I'm learning more that way.
I wish I had your voice, Jefferson. I wish I had that good voice, you know. I'm getting that old man thing, you know, with the pipes over there.
You know, I'm very disappointed that I don't sound like Optimus Prime. That's the thing, if I had that voice.
You have a filter for that.
Thank you so much for joining us, George. We really appreciate it. Great
Let's
film.
Do this again.
Yes. Yeah, do this again. I look forward to seeing more of your films. And on behalf of Critical Not Cynical, I am Big J here with V-Man and Frank and our guest George. Everyone, live long and prosper.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us at patreon.com/beyondtrek.
We are Beyond Trek Podcast. Lower your inhibitions and surrender your years. We will add inspirational and hilarious Trek content to your day. Your attention will adapt to subscribe to us. Resistance is futile.